Hello and welcome to Pardes from Jerusalem, the podcast series from the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies in Jerusalem. I'm Larry Kluger, a Pardes alum. This week, Korach. This week, Rabbi Howard Marcos discusses Korach. Rabbi Howard Marcos is a member of the Pardes faculty. And now, Rabbi Howard Marcos.
Thank you, Larry. The parasha which we're going to explore today is named after the arch antagonist of the 16th to 18th chapters of Bamidbar, Numbers, namely Korach. When asked why the Torah portion is named after such a villain, as it were, one answer, the one I like the best, is that the second word in the Torah reading is Korach, and the weekly Torah portions are all traditionally named based on the first important word in the parasha. And in our case, Korach it is. The parasha begins with the words Vayikach Korach ben Yitzhar ben Kehat ben Levi. Korach, son of Yitzhar, son of Kehat, son of Levi, took, and so on. So the Torah portion is entitled Korach. This, of course, prompts an interesting question. Why is the portion not called Vayikach? That's the first word of the parasha. After all, in the book of Bereshit, Genesis, many of the weekly Torah portions have names that again are based on the first important word in the parasha, such as Vayitze, he went out, Vayishlach, he sent, Vayigash, he approached, all opening verbs that precede the name of an important character in the section. Vayitze Yaakov mi Be'er Shava, Vayelech Charana. Jacob went out of Be'er Sheva and traveled towards Haran. Or Vayishlach Yaakov Malachim Lefanav, Jacob sent messengers to him. Vayigash Elav Yehuda, Judah approached him. These are just a few examples, and there are more. Why were these portions not named Yaakov or Yehuda? And our portion, which begins Vayikach Korach, is named Korach and not Vayikach. I don't believe that there's one correct answer to this question. One might speculate that in the stories of the early patriarchs, the names of the characters appeared quite frequently, so the rabbis focused as much on their actions as they did on their personalities, which had a chance to develop over time as we followed them from youth to adulthood. In contrast to this, the stories in the book of Bamidbar, in the book of Numbers, are less about the lives and times of the characters, and more about the particular contribution, whether positive or negative, to the circumstances of the Israelites in the wilderness. Whereas we know a great deal about Isaac and his relationship with his sons, we know very little about Yitzhar, Korach's father, nor are we provided with any background or early childhood history about Korach or any of the other characters in the book of Numbers, including Yehoshua, Kalev, Datan, Aviram, Balak, Bilam, and many others. As a result of this very different literary approach in the post-Genesis text, the focus of what's important shifts from the development of the character of many of the patriarchs and matriarchs in the book of Bereshit to the one-off episode involving certain characters in the book of Bamidbar. Who are the five personalities in our Torah who merited, as it were, a parasha to be named after them? Not Avraham, although one of our parshiot is called Chayei Sarah, beginning with the stories which followed the death of our matriarch Sarah, and not Isaac, and not Jacob, not Rebekah, Rachel, nor Leah, not Joseph or any of his siblings, and not even Moses or Aaron, after whom Parshiot could certainly have been named. Instead, we have Noach in Bereshit, Yitro in Shmot, and Korach, Balak, and Pinchas in Bamidbar, and that's it. These five are either non-Israelites or a member of the Israelite people to whom there is attached some questionable act. These men are not evil. They're not heroes either. Rather, they all make important cameo appearances in the drama that is the Torah, and the stories that are reported around them are what provide the morals and lessons which we as readers are encouraged to embrace. So our subject today is Korach, a Levite from the family of Kehat, who chose to rally his supporters against the leaders of the people, namely Moses and Aaron. It seems that Korach was the son of Yitzhar, Amram's younger brother. The rabbis suggest that Korach was upset because, as he saw it, once the children of the eldest, Amram, namely Aaron and Moses, assumed the ultimate leadership over the priesthood and the entire nation, respectively, it was only right that the next important position in the camp should go to him, being the oldest son of the next oldest in the Kehat family. Instead, Korach gets word in Numbers 3:30 that Unasi veit av lemishpachot ha-kehati Elitzafan ben Uziel, the chieftain of the ancestral house of the Kohite clan, was Elitzafan, son of Uziel. Uziel was the youngest of the four sons of Kehat, not the next oldest, and yet it was his family that was promoted to the chieftainship. And if this wasn't enough of a slight, recall that when tragedy struck in Aaron and Elisheva's home with the deaths of their sons Nadav and Avihu, Moses gives instructions to the same Elitzafan to look after the burial of the brothers and not the next in line for honor, namely Korach. We are therefore looking at a man who feels that he and his family have been passed over for positions of honor by Aaron and by Moses, causing him to respond to this insult. Were I to suggest the content of a conversation that Korach may have had with whoever would give him time and attention, it would be something like this. It's really unfair that Moses and Aaron have all the power in this camp, and who gives them the right to appoint anyone they want anyway? Should the appointments not go according to the age-old army code of RHIP, rank has its privileges, such that the oldest of the oldest should be afforded the next slate of honors, namely being the chief of the whole tribe? I think that this is a cogent argument. Let's see, who can I talk to about this who might be sympathetic to my cause? I know, I'll go to someone from the tribe of Reuven. He was the oldest of Jacob's sons, so it is clear that he has rank. But it seems that when the people assembled to begin the march from the wilderness of Sinai to Kadesh in Transjordan, it was reported in Numbers 10, verses 13 and 14, Vayis'u barishona al pi Adonai biyad Moshe, when the march was to begin at the Lord's command through Moses, Vayisa degel machane v'nei Yehuda barishona letzivotam. The first standard to set out, troop by troop, was the division of Judah. Judah, the second born, is given the honor of leading the march through the wilderness. You, descendants of Reuven, like me, have been overlooked for a place of honor which is rightfully yours. What are we going to do about these insulting slights? Perhaps this is why the first verse of our Torah portion, Bamidbar 16:1, continues with the addition of more disgruntled individuals, these coming from the tribe of Reuven. The verse concludes, V'datan v'aviram b'nei Eliav v'on pen pelet b'nei Reuven. Korach got himself together along with Datan, Aviram, and On, all from the tribe of Reuben. We can certainly conjecture what the Reubenites' complaint to Moses and Aaron was about. It's our belief, O leaders, that respect, honor, and prestige has been bestowed upon members of other tribes before ours. We believe that we should have been the recipients of the aforementioned promotion. We, Datan and Aviram, and On, all from the tribe of Jacob's oldest son, Reuven, should have been selected along with our families to lead the march to Kadesh, instead of that overly aggressive Nachshon from the tribe of Judah. To this, Korach would chime in. I, your humble servant Korach, the oldest son of Yitzhar, the next oldest brother after your father Amram, should have been given the position of tribal chief over Elitzafan, oldest son of your father Amram's youngest brother Uziel. This might have been a reasonable discussion to have behind closed doors, But instead, Korach gathered his supporters and created a public outcry, gathering people together to mount his protest so that the members of the greater community could hear. We know that, just like the public outcry that took place when the spies returned from reconnoitering the land of Canaan, this rebellion of Korach ends in tragedy for the protesters. Today, I would like to look a bit more closely with you at the various objections. There were four of them that appear in our Torah, which created one messy protest. Upon further review, we can see that while the basis for the resentment had to do with Moses and Aaron's refusal, which was actually God's call in the first place, to give to these protesters what they believed they had coming to them, once the motive behind the protest had been established, four different parties with their own unique gripes emerged, demanding the attention of Moses and Aaron. The four rebellions are Korach, a Levite, not receiving the designation of clan head, Datan and Aviram, the Reubenites, being passed over for the lead role in the wilderness march, the tribal chieftains, men of repute, who joined forces with the Levites, looking to wrest control of the organizational administration from Moses and Aaron, and the entire community, who witnessed some very devastating destruction of thousands of Israelites, who were punished for their having chosen the path of mutiny over discussion and negotiation. Not only were there four fronts from which the rebellions originated, the Torah delineates four separate divine responses to the various insurrections, although I must tell you that the text is not totally clear as to who received which response. Nevertheless, is there something that we might be able to extrapolate regarding this episode? Let's take a look and see if perhaps there are lessons to be learned about four very different responses to the protesters. First of all, we are told that the ground opened up and swallowed Korach, Datan, and Aviram and their families. We learn, secondly, that a fire went forth and consumed 250 men, non-Levites, who aspired to become priests. Thirdly, a plague struck the complaining survivors, killing 14,700 people. And finally, Aaron's, and only Aaron's, staff sprouted almonds at the command of God when it was together with 11 other staves. The ground opened up its proverbial mouth and swallowed the ringleaders and their families. The sages tell us that this was surely a case of midah keneged midah, the punishment fitting the crime. While some of the other rebels joined Korach, leader of the rebellion, supporting him with their presence, Datan and Aviram, they were the ones that opened their mouths and declared out loud their contemptuous claims. Just as they opened their mouths in inappropriate insurrection, so too did the earth open its mouth to swallow them alive. Then there were the 250 men who were consumed by fire. Recall that Aaron's sons, Nadav and Avihu, were also consumed by fire. They were legitimate priests who offered illegitimate incense and as a result were consumed by fire, sent by God. These 250 men of our Torah portion were non-Levites who aspired to positions for which they were not qualified, but who offered legal sacrifices that would normally be acceptable. But still, just like Nadav and Avihu, they were consumed by a divine fire. While the verb form of the act of punishing by way of plague is found quite often in the Tanakh, the actual term for a plague itself used in the story of the rebellion of the surviving complainers, Negev, is found only seven times in the entire Bible. Contrast this with over two dozen examples in the Tanakh of the noun magefa, also meaning plague, a term that is even found in our story. The word magefa comes from the same root, nun gimel pei, as do the almost 50 cases of the verb form nagaf, to bring a plague. Among the seven verses using the word negef, the only other plague said to have actually visited the Israelites, most of the other references declare to a desire to avoid a plague, the lo yeh negef, etc., The other place where we find Negev is referenced by Joshua as he reprimands the 2.5 tribes of Israel encamped on the eastern side of the Jordan River who are toying with the idea of creating idolatrous ritual practices in their community. In his attempt to persuade the tribes of Gad, Manasseh, and Reuven not to sway from the worship of the Lord, Joshua makes reference to the plague that visited the Israelite camp when some of the people were enticed to worship the pagan god Baal Peor. We recall that in response to these actions, Pinchas came onto the scene, killed an Israelite and the Midianite woman who enticed the people to worship idols, and by doing so stayed a deadly plague. In telling this story in Bamidbar, that plague is called a magefa, whereas when Joshua makes reference to the same occurrence, he uses the word negef to describe the devastation. Thus, the infrequency of the use of the word negef allows us to connect our episode with the one in the wilderness involving the idol Baal Peor, which is described as an act of seduction into the worship of a foreign god undertaken by way of a clear and intentional rejection of the Lord, God of the Israelites. In our story, we come to realize that by declaring, Atem hamitem et am Adonai, you too have brought death upon the Lord's people, and in doing so, taking the side of the rebels, these men of the greater Israelite community display a lack of faith in God and in his appointed servants, an act which might be equated with a form of idolatry. If you are not completely with me, says God, then you are against me, and by extension, in favor of other gods, and I will not tolerate this disloyalty. This, then, is the rationale for the introduction of a plague into the Israelite camp as one of four divine reactions to the people's protests. Thus far, it seems that the punishments have been more or less appropriate for the crimes that were committed by the people. But what about the almonds sprouting on Aaron's staff and not on any of the others? What's the message of this strange phenomenon directed towards the vast complaining population? The verse is quite strange. We are told in Numbers 17:23, Vayhi mimochorat, vayavo Moshe el ohel ha'edut, vihine parach mate aharon levet levi, vayotze ferach, vayatzetz tzitz, vayigmol shkedim. The next day, Moses entered the tent of the pact, and there the staff of Aaron of the house of Levi had sprouted. It had brought forth sprouts, produced blossoms, and bore almonds. During the time that Moses was in the Ohel Ha'idut, did this staff undergo all three aspects of growth, sprouting, blossoming, and producing the almonds themselves? I think not. The only relevant part of this statement, I think, has to do with the almonds appearing on the staff, showing any and all observers the divine decision as to who was really in charge. There is no punishment here unless you consider the Holy One choosing sides as being a chastisement of the non-chosen party. There are very few other places besides our verse in Bamidbar that make reference to the almond, the shaked. Two of these references help to provide insight that we need to understand the choice of almonds sprouting as the way to display the Lord's support for Aaron. First of all, in the story of Joseph and his brothers, you recall that Jacob finally gives in and allows Judah and the brothers to take Benjamin with them to have another audience with Joseph, viceroy of Egypt. Their hope is that the Egyptian ruler will receive the gifts offered to him and release the incarcerated Simon. The text in Bereshit 43:11 tells us of Jacob's directive to his sons. Vayomer alehem Yisrael avihem, im kein efo zot asu, kechu mizimrat haaretz, bichlechem vehoridu laish mincha, me'at tzori, u'me'at dvash, nechot valot botnim ushkedim. Then their father Israel said to them, if it must be so, do this. Take some of the choice products of the land in your baggage and carry them down as a gift for the man. Some balm and some honey, gum, ladanum, pistachio nuts, and almonds. Shkedim, almonds, are mentioned in the list of choice products that the brothers take with them in hopes of appeasing the viceroy of Egypt. Then there's the vision that the prophet beholds in the first chapter of the book of Jeremiah. God asks his servant, Yirmiyahu, behold a vision. What do you see? Jeremiah answers, Makel shaked ani roe. I see a branch of an almond tree. Using a fantastic play on words, the Lord then says, you have seen correctly, ki shoked ani al devarai la'asoto, because I am watchful to bring my word to pass. I think that the intent is the same as the English phrase, I am looking to make things happen sooner rather than later. The shaked and its accompanying paronomasia, wordplay, indicate a divine determination to make things happen now and not later. The almonds in these two passages represent the choicest of gifts that were brought to Egypt and the symbol of immediate intent. By causing Aaron's rod to sprout almonds, the Lord is communicating to observers, whether they be the children of Israel who witnessed the sprouting rod or readers of the text who follow this troubling episode of mutiny and faithlessness, that he, God, is confirming his choice of Aaron to be the high priest, and the confirmation is intended to be confirmed immediately. There is no room for appeal. And while this phenomenon was not a punishment of the people per se, it did serve as a divine message to the Israelites that it is the Lord who is in charge, and it is the Lord who placed Moses and Aaron into positions of leadership and authority. Those who desired to rebel against his servants, said the Lord, were rebelling against God himself and would suffer appropriate consequences. Both the Torah text and the later portrayals in the Mishnah and Talmud placed Korach and his followers in a very negative light. While they may have had legitimate claims in a totally democratic society, their insurrection against Moses and Aaron was really a rebellion against God, something that the divine would never tolerate, hence the extreme response of the death of around 15,000 Israelites. For those of us reading this story, it might be a chance for a pair of takeaways. First, we can benefit by continuing to explore the question posed by Micha in his prophetic writings, chapter 6, verse 8. Higid lecha Adam, ma tov uma Adonai doresh mimcha, ki im asot mishpat ve'ahavat chesed, ve'hatznea lechet im Elohecha. He has told you, O man, what is good and what the Lord requires of you, only to do justice and to love goodness and to walk modestly with your God. It seems that Korach and his followers did not follow this advice. Secondly, we can come to learn from Korach's behavior that disagreement is not just about the facts. It is also about attitude and presentation. What may not be achieved through bullying and force might just be accomplished by way of sincere communication and an openness to dialogue. We then learn from this not to take Korach's path, but to try another approach in order to achieve our goals. For these lessons alone, we can be thankful that the story of Korach's rebellion appears in our Torah.
Thank you, Rabbi Marcos. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you in the next episode of Pardes from Jerusalem.